you wait just a minute so we can introduce you?
Oh, sure.
Okay. So this is our, obviously this is our first year at this new, beautiful, beautiful retreat center. We are so thankful to be here. And Sister Susan has been our contact, and she's dealt with us with a sense of humor and an open mind as we've worked through schedules. So do you have anything you would like to tell us? Don't put gum under your chairs.
Well, first of all, I just want to say how delighted I am that you're finally here. When Blake called me, it seems like it was like forever ago, and it's here already. Right, Blake?
Yeah, we did it. How about this?
And then I've been working with Sally, also known as Sylvia. I was working with another group with a lady called Sylvia, and I was emailing Sally, and I said, "Oh, it's Sylvia." And I said, "Oh, that's not Sylvia." That's so stupid. But anyway, we're delighted you're here. If you need anything, please let any of us know. When you leave on Sunday, you don't have to do anything. The only thing that we ask is put your towels on the sink so it'll be easier for our housekeepers to flip those rooms, because we have Rollheiser's retreat coming up. Have you ever heard of Rollheiser, Ron Rollheiser? He's the president of the Yavin School of Theology, and he's having his annual monstrous retreat starting Sunday. So that means we have to be all hands on deck. But anyway, you don't have to strip your beds. Just leave everything on the bed and put the towels on the sink. Okay? And again, we're really, really happy you're here.
So is there anything that's off limits to us when you go to the chapel? We can walk
in. Oh, I know this, yeah. Chapel. On Saturday, there's a group in there practicing for a retreat they're going to be having. And I think they're coming from like 1 to 4. And then at 4:30, the group that's going to be in that conference room is having Mass. So, and then they're finished with Mass at 6, and they have dinner. And so in the evening on Saturday, you'll have the chapel. And also you might want to ask for a key so you can get in and out, okay? So,
is that the reception?
Yeah, the reception desk. Okay?
Thank you for your hospitality.
Any questions for us? For me? Good. Okay.
Thank you so much.
The antenna's on the bottom.
Great.
Okay.
So, the antenna's on the bottom. That part. So, welcome to everybody. My name is Ann Johnson, and I live in Flagstaff, Arizona. I'm an ordained Episcopal priest who retired the 1st of July. Yay. And my 10th anniversary for ordination was last Saturday, which is kind of a milestone. So I'm going to ask if each of you all would go and we'll introduce the other abbots. And then I'm going to ask each of you all to go around, introduce yourselves, say where you're from, and tell me what your first car was. Do it quickly, we're going to live all night. But okay, so my first car was a 52 Ford, but I got it in 65, so you can imagine what kind of shape it was in, and I was really surprised and thrilled to have my own wheels.
I'm Blake Burleson, and I live in Waco, Texas. I'm an ordained Baptist minister, teach at Baylor University, and I'm one of the abbots. My first car was a 66 red Mustang.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You
can imagine. And my hair was about the same as it is now. It was about the same color. It was about the same length. Yeah.
I'm Lynn from Telephone, Texas. And my first car was a Volkswagen Beetle.
Of course it was. Ron
Whitman. I live in the attic over my son. I'm formerly homeless. surviving and eating well. First car, hold on now, 1952 Studebaker.
Oh, yeah.
I don't even think of it. My dad loved them though, but he helped me find this one in 1958.
Karen Poitman, and that was my first car too, but it didn't have a radio. So somehow we found a radio. You know how the cars have a pump? That kind of balance there, but boy, we had a radio.
I'm Michael Ceretti. I live in Chesapeake, Virginia. I'm also a Reformed Baptist minister. And my first car was an Oldsmobile Forenza. Yeah. Oldsmobile Forenza.
Come on. You can do better.
I'm Rex Foster. I am originally from San Antonio. I grew up about 10 minutes from here and never knew this place existed, so this is wonderful to know about. I live in Baltimore, which is my home now, has been for the last decade. My first car was a 67 Ford Mustang.
No.
It probably did not run as well as yours did. It didn't last very long, so, but it was a good idea.
It wasn't red. Was it red?
It was not red.
That's right.
My name is Sharon Grimes, and I'm from Longview, Texas. My first car was a 66 Blue Mustang.
I'm Jim Kennedy. I am an ordained Baptist minister and an associate professor of religion at Baylor University. And I have an 11-year-old granddaughter. And my first car was an early 70s Chevrolet Impala.
My name is Allison Hine. I live in Ann Arbor, Michigan. And my first car was a 67 Dodge Dart.
I'm Jim Kimmel. I live in San Marcos, Texas. My first car was a 1954 Ford, totally stripped down. It had been the car of my dad's lumberyard, so not a luxurious car, but dependable.
I'm Jerry Kimmel, and I live in San Marcos. And my first car was a Mercury Comet, 62 Mercury Comet, that was the color of Alice's shirt. One of my favorite colors. And I finally got to take it to Baylor when I was beginning to go into my senior year. So I finally had a car, and I met Jim a month later. Never drove it the next year. Gave it back to my parents.
By then we had a luxurious 1962 Ford Falcon.
I'm Sally Roberts, also known as Sylvia. I'm from Carrollton, Texas. My first car was a 1972 Toyota Corolla, which my father decided could be his first attempt at actually painting a car. Ooh. So it and our garage was red.
My name is Sam Roberts. I'm also from Carrollton, Texas, and very disappointed here. Sylvia.
I'm Darren Poitman. I'm from San Antonio, Texas.
'62 Chevy Nova, 3-speed Honda Carro, 2-door hardtop. Okay, so prettiest one there was.
David Von Miller. I live in San Marcos, Texas. My first car was a 1960 Catalina. It had push button instead of a gear shift, you push the button. Automatic transmission, and the floorboard was rotted out in the back. So
Orange Toyota Corolla hatchback. It was
a 77, not because I was really, really young when I got it, but it was the first car I had when I got my first real job at the age of 23.
My name is Donnie Hungerford from Austin, Texas. And my first car was a lime green 1968 Mercury Montego. It was a hand-me-down from my parents that I proceeded to round off all the fenders on.
Lime green, huh? Okay. So we are so excited that you're here. We spent a lot of time, again, organizing the next 3 days, really considering where we are in the state of the world right now. And so we hope that the activities that we've planned will be meaningful to you all and to all of us that did them. We also will plan time for you all, some downtime for you all to get to know each other. Each one of you is unique and wonderful and a blessing to everybody else. So take time during this week or this weekend to find time to visit with each and every person that's here. So right now, Blake is going to tell us about the schedule, and then we're going to proceed with the rest of the evening.
Schedule is headed around, so this is the moment, Donnie, you get to have the schedule. Donnie came up to me a while ago and he says, is there a schedule? So the tradition of the order is that we don't give you the schedule until you get here, right? And now you have it.
All right.
The theme of the week, or it's not a week now, it's a weekend. It's the angel of prophecy in a world of chaos. And last year we made a few changes to the annual gathering. We had done a little survey that Anna had put together the year before. And two of the most important things that you said that we need to be doing is worshiping together. It's really the only time of the year that the order gets together to worship together as a group. But we do it in pockets in a number of places, but it's really only here in the annual gathering that we do that. So one of the most important things that we do is our time in chapel. And maybe that's the most important thing we do, is our time in chapel. The other thing that you said was that you wanted more time really just to talk to each other. And so we had changed the schedule a bit last year to reflect that in giving you a bit more free time to have time to converse with each other, but also to introduce what we call the talking stick, where we share with each other what's going on. And we actually have a new talking stick. It looks actually more like a club, so.
That's okay, somebody talks.
Yeah, if you cross-talk, right, then you're in big trouble. So, take a look at the schedule here tonight. Of course, we will begin with the introduction to the theme with one of our keynotes that Lynn will be doing. Then we'll have chapel. Friday morning, begin with chapel, and you notice the beautiful chapel we have set. It's not going to be quite like Way of the Wolf, right? But it's really nice, and I know all of you see it. Thank you guys that put that together. It looks like us. It's really beautiful. Thank you for doing that. So we begin with chapel in the morning, then breakfast. Jim Kennedy will be doing one of the keynotes, and then Lynn will be finalizing the keynote, again, thinking about prophecy, particularly at this time in our lives as a nation and as a world. Small group discussions, and then we have lunch, and then a rest reflection period. You notice from 3 to 5, one of the things you also said last year that we did was you wanted less time in your seats. Right, so most of the seat time is in the morning, and then afternoon is more moving about, and that will include some imaginal compassion practices that will be led by the monks. And There'll be four options for you there. If you pass it that way, then let me have one of those here. This, actually, I'll wait until that gets around and we'll come back and talk about it. But I wanted you to see the four choices you'll have tomorrow for these imaginal practices, and we'll tell you a little bit about that so you can begin to think about which of the four you might want to participate in. Then we have dinner, come back for talking stick, and then chapel. You'll turn the page to Saturday. You'll notice the talking stick. We have, I think, four different sessions for that throughout the weekend where we're listening to each other. And then 10 to 12, we have four month presentations that will be led by Sharon, Michael Rex, Allison, and Jim Kimmel. Then lunch, and then again, got some hours there for rest and reflection. We'll have a chapel, and then we have movement exercises led by some of our monks. So you have choices there of labyrinth, tai chi, and yoga. And again, talking stick. And then one of our highlights of the weekend will be our ordination of new monks and priests and reception. And Sunday, we typically have basically two things, and that's worship together and then also matters of discussion for the order that we'll do. Notice this optional event, we tried to squeeze actually a field trip in, but we hated to lose time with each other doing that because you have to travel. But if you haven't been to the Missions of Texas, it's now a UNESCO World Heritage Site. It's one of the best things I've ever done as a tourist in Texas. Really fantastic. If you have time, you can take all day and go to all, five of them?
Six,
yeah. And they're on the river. You can even ride your bike to each one of them. The rental bikes are really easy to use, or you can drive the car, or if you just go to one of them. You were just going to go to one, San Jose, maybe?
That's the big one.
That's the big one, and it has a film, and it's sort of it's reconstructed so you can see really what it really looked like. Of course, everybody goes to Alamo.
The last two on the very end are still functioning parishes. And one time I went to one of those, I can't remember, and there was a wedding going on.
Right.
I said the last two of the trail are very small, and they're still functioning as parishes. So I don't know if they've been continuously in use for 500 years, probably. But anyway, I was saying that one time we were doing the tour and actually came upon a wedding that was at one of them. It's really beautiful.
Yeah, I just can't recommend it enough. I've been several times, and every time I go, I learn something new. And also just feel the presence of these Franciscan monks that came to Texas and prayed and worked. They were contemplatives in the workplace, and they have some resonation with our own existence here. Okay, so if you would take a look at the four compassion practices. Jim and Sharon and I were driving from Waco today talking about our lives and what's been going on for each of us over the last few weeks. In some ways, each of us are called in different ways to action of some sort. And we'll talk more about that during the weekend. But as I've been called to action, one of the things that I'm wanting to do is to have a pure heart as I do that. So that means, how do I love my neighbor? How do I love my enemy? How do I love myself during this time of chaos? So I need help. I need help in doing that. And I know many of us need help. And how do we do that with love? How do we take stands that we may have to take, but we do that in love? So these are four practices. And I'd like each of the Abbots to just say briefly, take a minute if you would, say briefly what your practice will be that you'll be leading us in. And you also have a paragraph which you can take with you to take home. So tonight, kind of think about, okay, where do I need to work, right? What do I need to work on? And then you've got four choices for tomorrow, I think at 3 o'clock, that you would have an opportunity to do. So we'll start with Sacred Warrior Tradition by Bearing Witness.
Sometimes that term sacred warrior tends to be a turnoff, but I would say that the first person I knew who carried that banner in our tradition and in our time frame as a contemporary was Nelson Mandela. He was identified as the epitome of a sacred warrior. We're going to use a little bit of the basis from a sacred warrior, but more importantly, more directly, we'll be looking at the world through the eyes of burning glassman, that is that sense of bearing witness to what is. Not what we'd like it to be, not what we'd expect it to be, not what we think it should be, but to bear witness to what it is. And in doing so, we'll be holding in prayer, music, and practice for all the groups, all the other groups that are doing their action and imaginal practices throughout the weekend, or throughout that 2-hour period. I'll just call your attention to Richard Rohr's statements, being present to the moment, to the now, without judgment, analysis, or critique, without your ego deciding whether you like it or not. Reality does not need us to like it in order to be reality.
Lens is the second one.
If we thought of practice in this particular world that we're in, there's inner practice and outer practice, and both need to be balanced. The one that I will be leading is an outer practice of engaging another, a stranger. It's easy to engage friends, but it's far more difficult to engage a stranger. But attempting to not only stay at the surface, but to reach some possible depth. And we'll be talking about that and practicing it. How could we engage a stranger in a certain amount of time and reach a level of discourse that is really beyond the hello, how are you, to a place of deep listening, deep compassion. So we'll be experimenting to see what happens.
Well, this opportunity is entitled This Teacher Named Anger. There are a lot of emotions around, especially in this world of chaos that we're talking about. So we hope to have conversation about anger, to explore it together. Something that actually, the feeling that it lasts only 90 seconds in our body, how come some of us hold on to that anger and resentment years and years and years? So I think it's going to be an opportunity for us to sharing, to learn about the language of emotion. And Sally's going to have a Qigong exercise, which I've never done, so I'm excited about trying something new.
And the final one, Ann and I will be doing is called Becoming the Other. And we'll be leaving campus and imagining what it is like to be a Muslim in this country by wearing a hijab or a keffiyeh in a public place. And so it's actually something I've been doing over several weeks. And it's really observing yourself and what that feels like to be the other. And I've really learned things, and I've taught world religions for 30 years. And in doing this, I've learned some things that I didn't know. It's really interesting. So We will be going off campus, and Lynn will be going off campus. Ron will be on campus, and Karen and Sally and Sam will be on campus. So think about this over the evening, right? And see, really think about, what do I need at this point as I engage in the world that I'm in a world of chaos? What do I need to work on in order to do that in an effective way, in a way that is loving? So that's your schedule, and including these imaginal practices.
And we have hijabs and
right.
That's everybody.
That's right. So you don't have to bring your own.
We have a bunch.
Yeah, we have the costumes. So yeah, we have. And so I think we've got plenty. Probably. Yeah. So all right. Any other habits? Anything? Any other housekeeping matters that we need to address before we move into the keynote?
I'll take
money
whenever
anybody wants to come. Okay, so each of you have received the bill, right? So Sam is collecting the what you owe, and you'll be doing that throughout the weekend. So we don't have to do it today. We can wait and still get interested.
Absolutely. But I will come back again on Sunday.
We have a new person.
Debbie, you snuck in. I didn't see you.
Oh, I let you kids.
I didn't. Well, welcome.
Thank you.
Great
Sorry
to see
I
you.
Had to be late.
Well, we were introducing ourselves a while ago, and one of the things we were asked to do is to tell what our first car was. So, do you want to tell us what it is? This is a very personal thing to reveal.
Oh, it was this wonderful. I learned how to drive on a 1964 red Volkswagen Beetlebug.
Okay. Right. Here's another Beetlebug.
That was my first car. And now I have a 1958 one.
Okay. Well, we're so glad you're here.
Thank you.
What a great group we have. Any other matters before we turn it over to Lynn? All right. And by the way, let's give Sally a round of applause. Get us here. It's a lot of work, a lot of care went into it, and done so well. So thank you very much.
I would like us to begin with our normal ringing of the bell and a period of silence, and then just below our podium here is a seal that we wear, and of course all of you can read the Arabic, or almost, and let us say that together as our prayer in both Arabic and in English, and then we'll begin. Pray together, Bismillah Rahman Rahim, in the name of the Holy One,
the Merciful, the Compassionate.
Amen. I feel privileged to be with you, and I prepared realizing that we were going to be in a totally new place. We were changing as the world is changing. So in a certain way, this gathering is a reflection of the very events that we're going through, maybe personally and as a nation. And here we are in a new place. We're adjusting. We're being forced to adjust to a new situation. And yet, as I see you, I feel so fortunate. I feel that this is both a place of immense sensitivity, and also I feel a place of wonder. You are precious to me, and I feel that our gathering is a true gift, that we give each other our friendship, we give each other our presence, we give each other our care and our love at a moment in time when things are changing, things are shifting. Maybe this is a moment, as we said, not only of chaos, but of gathering light and also gathering darkness. It feels to me in some way, as I've been reflecting these last months, that we're entering a battle for the soul of our world. Maybe a battle for the soul of all humankind. And certainly we can see it's a battle for the soul of the earth. So this is a momentous time. This is a gathering of elders. We're the elders of the earth. And we gather in solidarity with many others who are at this moment realizing, okay, it's in our hands. Perhaps this is C.S. Lewis's last battle. If you read the Narnia series, it crescendos in the last battle. And the world changes. And the whole effect of the Narnia series is to go from little children, in a certain sense, who are very, very vulnerable, to a great crescendo last battle. And that's true of the science fiction series, The Three, where the Earth changes as a result of the chaos. So this may be the perfect storm. All my life I've had sort of hints and intuitions that we would reach, that in my lifetime, we would reach a perfect storm. My little kids, as they were growing up, each one of them had dreams as they were growing up and report to Jackie and me of dreaming of a kind of perfect storm in the future. And we pondered that as a family. So this may be, in fact, what we've called and thought about over the years as the tipping point, where there is a transformation of the world or a cascading collapse or both, that the two are happening simultaneously. But you can feel the intensity and you can feel the awakening as I sort of move about and keep my ear open and listen to people. I realize that there's an incredible intensity in the hearts of our fellow human beings, and there is a kind of awakening. It doesn't mean that we're all awakening to the same vision. In fact, some seem to be awakening to a dark vision. But there's an awakening. And you can sense that there is a kind of growing, rolling, chaotic movement. But you can also sense that there is a kind of anticipation. What's going to happen? What's up ahead? We're entering what I think our tradition rightly called the unveiling, the moment of unveiling, the apocalypsis. And that was foreseen by the Abrahamic faiths. In fact, the three Abrahamic faiths basically agree on this particular point, that there will be a time when we will wake up and the
veil will be stripped, or what the Eastern tradition said would be the Maya, the veil of illusion would be stripped away, and we would see, in fact, what is real. And I think that's the key, that the unveiling, and even the chaotic unveiling of things, leads you to understand what is real, as opposed to what was not real, as opposed to what you thought might be real, but it turns out not to be true. So we're in a world where the chaos is swirling around us, and you would have to agree at this particular point, 3 weeks into his presidency, that our president is an exquisite man of chaos. Everything is being upset, and the word unprecedented is being used almost every time you turn on the television. This is unprecedented. We've never had this happen before. So you can see that we're entering nationally into a kind of new nation, or a new set of facts, or a new set of alternatives, or a new set of realities. But it's not just America. It's across the world. And almost everywhere you look, every quarter of the world, you can see that there's this kind of effect, this unveiling, this chaotic stripping away of what we might have thought as, okay, the normal real. Now, I want to say this about our new president. He is not our enemy. And he cannot be the focus of our work. I think what we have to realize, we can't fix him. We may not be able to fix the nation. It may not be our job to do anything that has anything remotely to do with fixing anything. As I've watched my own inner process the last several months since the election, I've gone from the normal stages, I think, of grief. I've gone from denial, this cannot be happening, to bargaining, well, if we just did this or just did that, we could, you know, change it, fix it, to anger and to depression. But I think, personally, I've reached a point of acceptance. That this is what is. This is the world that God has given us. This is the world in which wisdom has to work. And this sort of, okay, this is it. I'm settling into it. I think before we think about anything of adjusting, what we need to first focus on is how chaos transforms us. Change and change agency that we see all around us obviously affects the way things turn out, but what it has to begin to do first is to affect me. That this chaotic change that we see around us is in fact going to have to settle into my own being, and I'm going to have to accept what is coming as a way of changing my own being. So we might see that what we're here for is not to change anything, but to allow change to come to us, and then to bring out of wisdom's storehouse the great treasuries of light and the great treasuries of compassion. That's what chaos is going to have to force inside of us. The capacity to reach deeply into the treasury of the wisdom tradition and draw out the treasures and allow them to change us and allow those to be the medicine that in a certain sense can heal the world. So my sense is that, yes, our president is a chaos maker, but maybe his secret role is to act as a change agent. Maybe he's one of God's hired hands in this moment. That the divine has, as has happened throughout history, has set into place certain events that will actually bring about the evolution of the world. And wonder if at this moment we're here witnessing, and we're being asked to witness one of the stepping stones or one of the turning points of the evolution of the world. And so this is a rapid time. This is a rapid place where the tipping point is not a tipping point ideologically, but ontologically, where we're beginning to be changed in consciousness and in being. And it takes something strong to do that. You can argue all day, you can give people theological dispositions, but that doesn't change the consciousness and the being of an individual. Only real existential chaos can actually bring about our capacity to open ourselves to what is perhaps waiting for us. So let's think carefully about chaos theory. Chaos theory came about decades ago as an awareness that in the midst of chaos, underneath it and behind it, is some sort of hidden pattern. I think our ancient tradition called that pattern the Logos. And I'm going to show you tomorrow some images of the Logos that perhaps stands in back of this chaotic and rapid movement. But at this particular point of extreme change is a point of intense and exquisite sensitivity. It's called the butterfly effect. And tonight, before we end, I'm going to show you something that I think is really remarkable to help us see that whatever we do, whatever we allow to occur inside of us, whatever change begins to occur inside of us, has a very powerful effect as it ripples out upon the world. And we always think of ourselves as insufficient, or whatever it is that we are, or whoever it is that we are, it can't make a difference. But in chaos theory, this moment of intense chaos is a sensitive place, a portentous place, an intense place where all the trajectories are being prepared for the future. And we have ready at hand an ability to add our weight to the way the trajectories begin to move. So in this new and chaotic world, what is being called out of us is new intuition, deep listening, deep insight. And our tradition says that at this moment, the angel of prophecy will be extraordinarily active. That when the images of this particular apocalyptic moment arrive, that in fact the forces of heaven are really very, very active. And that means we, who are called into a deep listening to those forces, have to be extraordinarily open, extraordinarily able to be listening in a way that perhaps we've never listened before. The new world calls for this world under the aegis of change and chaos. In our biblical tradition says this. This comes from the prophet Joel. And it shall come to pass in these days that I will pour out my spirit upon all flesh. Your sons and your daughters shall begin to prophesy. Your elders shall dream dreams. Your young people will begin to see visions. And I will pour out my spirit upon you and upon your servants and your handmaidens, and I will show wonders in the heavens and on the earth. There will be blood and fire, pillars of smoke. The sun will be darkened. The moon shall turn red like blood before that day when the Lord appears. And it shall be that whoever invokes the divine name shall be delivered. That's probably a 2,500-year-old prophecy. Other text in our tradition says, look, Behold, I am going to make everything new. Everything. And that means we who are listening have to hear what is being made new. Or in colloquial English, we have to really begin to think outside the box. Those who are the elders upon whom the Spirit will be poured need to be open, because the Spirit is going to make things new. So chaos, yes, on the one hand, and agents of chaos that we can identify, but those who are sages and those who are wisdom seekers, they're the ones that receive the voice from the angel of prophecy. Listen to these amazing words. You've heard them. Some of you are thinking that perhaps I, Yeshua, have come into this cosmos to bring it peace. No. You do not yet realize that I've come to throw it into utter chaos through burning blade and battle. Five will be living in a household. Three will face off against two. Two against three. Parents will rise up against their children. Children against their parents. Until, at last, they can stand together on their own two feet. Thomas Logian, 16. So, what your eyes cannot normally see, what your ears as a human cannot normally hear, what your physical hands usually cannot touch, what is inconceivable to the human mind, that is what I'm going to give you. Logian 17. Yeshua says, I stood to my feet in the midst of this chaos. I appeared outwardly in flesh. I discovered that everyone was drunk and no one was thirsty. And my soul ached for the children of humanity. For their hearts are blind. They cannot see from within. They've come into the cosmos empty, and they're leaving it empty. At the moment, you are inebriated, but when free from the effects of wine, you too may turn and stand. Oh, blessed are you who are awake and aware of the approach of thieves, who know when and where they will enter even before they appear. Blessed are you who become precognitive. For then you may rise and prepare yourself by gathering your sovereignty about you and bind to yourself that which belonged to you from your beginning. That's Logian 103. Let me read it again. Blessed are you who are awake and aware of the approach of thieves, who know when and where they will enter even before they appear. For then you can rise and prepare yourselves by gathering your sovereignty about you, and then bind to yourself that which belonged to you from your beginning. I think amazing and prophetic words. So, hearing this, you can say to sages and elders and seekers and transmitters of wisdom that you were brought here on purpose to this earth for this moment. We were made for this particular download of Sophianic intensity. And I'm expecting it. And I'm expecting it in you. So we gather here to gain strength, to be able to listen to the angel of prophecy, to this time of intensity, to the tipping point. And I think, I know I do, feel like a little hobbit. Hobbit in Mordor. You know, why me? Why you? Why this amount of intensity? You know, truly the weakest of the weak, right? I mean, we all feel that. I'm not able to carry this. Yeah, but you were chosen. And perhaps you chose. Who's to say? Among the signs, the outer signs of chaos that we're experiencing, and I think we'll continue to experience if the world is moving in the direction it seems to be, there, I think, is arising the very thing that Yeshua said, an inner sovereignty, an inner authority. You can start to feel it. So in the midst of your own sense of vulnerability and your sense of even fear, because who can't not look at the world and, in a certain sense, be afraid? But what has to come into the fear base is braver. A willingness to be a hobbit in Mordor with the intensity of the fear. So part of that, our exercise tomorrow, is to meet the fear base that we each have and to walk out and do something brave. Those of us that are going off campus, it's not, you know, a huge deal, but it's going beyond our normal box and trying something new and to, in a certain sense, build up stamina for the world that is in place. So we have a deep responsibility to the world, a deep responsibility to ourselves, to transmit, I believe, not from our own personal perspective, but from the perspective of our tradition, the perspective of the transmission of the wisdom transmission of Yeshua, and from the perspective of the angel. What does that mean? It means, from my sense of things, that I'm to stay in touch with and listen intensely to the voice that is going to begin to speak more and more clearly as I open myself and am more and more sensitive to it. So the voice of the angel is, according to our tradition, is speaking. The images say that as time moves towards its tipping point, as time moves towards its evolution, as the divine remakes the world, however the divine chooses to do that, that the angels will be present. The visionary tradition of the Abrahamic faith say that the angels will be present. So the angels of Apocalypse will be present in the midst of chaos. That's the promise. My sense is that if we begin to support one another and we begin to do as much in-service training as we can do before, as it says in the Bible, the shit hits the fan. before the chaos seems to overwhelm us, that we'll be braver, better prepared. So part of the work that, as we met as abbots before the gathering here, we're thinking, what is our responsibility? What, you know, together, what can we do to encourage one another, to have each other's back, to listen more intensely? To receive this transmission, because we're here to receive it. We realized what we needed was to have an opportunity to do some training, to do some listening, to work together on our capacity to be receivers in the midst of this kind of world and then transmitters as much as we possibly can. That means we develop as we can the most intensely open and sensitive heart that we've ever had. That we listen to both what is ancient and what is new, because what is ancient is the lineage that we receive, and what is new is what the angel of prophecy is bringing to this particular moment. The Gospel of Philip says that the angels are speaking through the icons. That's an interesting phrase. You could say that the angels are speaking through images. The angels are speaking through metaphors. The angels are speaking through a language that is beyond rational discourse. That's why argument is not going to change the world. It's more likely that beauty will change the world than argument. The prophets, when they began to speak, their attempt was to awaken people so that they could see the world as it actually was. They could see what damage humans were doing to other human beings. So the world, by definition, is a difficult place. And what the prophetic voice does is to awaken us to see what is true and what is real, to wake us up, and then to give us strength and stamina and to be brave. To stand up bravely in the midst of our own inner fear and outer chaos. That's the stamina that we need to build. I don't think that national politics is going to solve this. So we need not to be focused on partisanship, especially as a community here. That's not our work. We may have our personal preferences to parties and systems, but our work transcends that. It draws down something from a different source, a source that is both ancient and new. So what we're doing is preparing ourselves to listen exquisitely to the guidance and to the instruction that is going to come to us, and then begin to play roles and become practitioners of this work and support one another as we listen and act. Remember, in the Semitic tradition, the whole metaphor of the journey said that in order to survive this kind of terrain that we're entering, we needed to caravan together. So, this is our caravan. We're going across difficult terrain. This is our caravan sarai, the place where the pilgrims gather in the times of intense danger. So we need fresh inspiration. We need fresh input. We need to hear, I need to hear your voice, and you need to hear mine as we prepare ourselves. So I want to show you a few images that I think speak to this. And these images are obviously a gift from our sister Allison, who's helped us to begin to perceive the imaginal, to hear and see the metaphors in a new way. So I think this will work. Technology is sometimes my friend, and sometimes it's not.
Do you
want
the lights off,
please? Yeah, maybe that is a good idea, if we can turn them down a little bit. This image, did something happen?
Just the screen.
All right. This particular image suggests that our own individual consciousness is aware of two worlds. So what do you see? Yes, let me make it bigger. So this is you. This is your own individual consciousness. And your own individual consciousness is aware in the outer world of what? Perfect. It's good, Ron. It's great.
What's the question?
So we have an image of a head, meaning our awareness, our individual personal awareness, and in the midst of the world, on the outside, we're surrounded by what?
Storm clouds.
Water.
Yeah, water. And water is almost always the clouds, water, storm, rain. It's always been the metaphor for what?
Subconscious.
Yes, chaos, subconscious, both chaos inwardly perhaps, but in this particular case, we're feeling the instability like the waves of the ocean. Into that steps what?
Wisdom tradition.
Yeah. So who might that be?
Yeshua.
Could be Yeshua.
Could be a prophet.
Could be a prophet.
Better.
Could be. And so it's absolutely true that in the middle of chaos, when things are the most vulnerable, that the voice, prophetic voice, the voice of prophecy, the voice of the angel begins to speak, but it doesn't necessarily affect the outer world. It has to affect the inner world first.
The other thing that's interesting about this image is if you can make it big again, is that on the left side there, you can see sort of this sort of strange ratcheted kind of shapes, right?
Cues.
And to me, that is the confrontation of this force of Yeshua against our own inner egoic structures of rigidity and compartmentalization. So it burns, and it's exposing that.
It is, great. So that's a kind of unveiling. Tearing the clouds away, dealing with the inner chaos. This image arrived yesterday, the day before.
It's amazing.
And when it hit the deck for me, I looked at it and I said, that's exactly what I'm sensing about where we are. The outer world is chaotic. It's going to be chaotic, and the likelihood of it becoming more chaotic is high. But where the vision begins is not on the outside, it begins on the inside. And we don't typically trust that. Or we have a tendency not to trust it, to say, well, the authority has to be outside. But Yeshua said, no, when you awaken, you begin to gather in you, from your beginning, your own inner authority. And it has to be an intense kind of listening. Yes?
I think it's really interesting. Yoga teaches that the divine energy comes in and back here for the Madhuva Avangada. Right, we have that.
So she's anatomically correct.
But so the trick with yoga breathing is to pull that in, run it down the spine, back up the spine.
Good.
And that's where the will resides.
So this is an inner practice of deep awareness and listening, and the revelation, the angel of prophecy is an angel of revelation. But we tend to think of it as a revelation to the outer world, when in fact, the appearing of Yeshua His second appearing may be in the inner world, at least first. So I grew up as a fundamentalist where we were looking for all the signs of Christ appearing in the clouds, and we were going, we had our telescopes out. Well, it's not that one. It looks like a bunny. So we tended to be totally outward focused, and we did not trust. I was taught not to trust the inward voice. That was prejudice that my tradition had at that point. But Yeshua says, no, no, it's the opposite. So it's a beautiful image. David.
So I was wondering, is that how you interpret, was it Logan 16, where he says he's not come to bring peace, but to bring chaos to the cosmos of that inner cosmos?
That's the way Islam will interpret jihad. Struggle is not really the outer. That is always typically a misguided and then becomes eventually a kind of terroristic act. But what is really true is the inner struggle. And it looks something perhaps like this. But this image is one of beauty, of intense beauty. It's not ugly at all. It's beautiful in the midst of the chaos. So you can sense that, you know, we think, some of you have been reading, and it's an interesting article by Ken Wilber on the post-Trump world. He's critiquing the world of the green meme, if you're familiar with those colors as human consciousness evolves, but he's really critiquing the narcissism of American elitism. And maybe there is a whole backlash against that because there's been a kind of narcissism, a sense of privilege. So the struggle that Yeshua describes, Yeshua throwing fire into the cosmos, may be in fact to shake us up out of the comfort zone. Because we all love the privilege of the comfort zone. I deserve to have a comfortable and safe life. That's been the American dream. But maybe this whole shakeup is so I can stand on my own 2 feet. Interesting way to begin to interpret that. Any other comments about this particular image? Thank you, Allison. It's
Lynn.
Yes, please.
When I look at it, the other feeling I get is that if I look at the way I look at reality out the front yard along the side, I see optimism.
So the right chaos and the left chaos are different in the way you're seeing it?
Yes, it's unknowing to me. I don't know what it is.
Okay, good. That's a great scene.
I have an optimistic feeling when I look to the right.
Good.
The reds, the yellows, the stars.
Yeah, there's a cosmic feel. Exactly. Exactly. And so this, you know, it's fire and water. Got that image going. You have inner and outer. You have a forward looking into, at least the way this is constructed, into that chaotic, watery experience that we're experiencing. And yet appearing, it's the epiphany which the divine said it would do in the midst of this. Joel said it, Jesus said it, and we begin to experience a new inner authority. So wisdom transmitted is a wisdom transmitted not with hesitancy, but with some kind of inner sovereignty, inner authority. Yes, Sally.
True blood, love that will hurt me. That looks like cause and wheel around. Like, that reminds me of a system. If organized, it's
going to work in the fashion that it's supposed to work in. So that, that brings order to the chaos outside.
So you would see that image is a potential to bring order out of chaos, which is one of the theories that what looks like absolute, utter, unbelievable, unsustainable chaos, behind it lurking is this pattern. So with that in mind, let me show you this image if I think I can get to it quickly. I think this is the right one. It's hard to see. Yes. So let's imagine that our world started to look more and more unsustainable. When Allison did this, she did it for me. I asked for something like this, and I got it. Lurking behind what is fearful and chaotic is this pattern, which is, in fact, what chaos theory says, that as we reach this moment of very frightening moment of chaos, lurking behind it is this pattern of higher than the chaos, greater than the chaos. But in order to know it, we have to be exquisitely sensitive to it. Because what hits us first is the chaos. And what we believe in first is the chaos. And it's maybe that that needs to be stripped away so that we can begin to touch the order. So this image may be, in fact, the juxtapositioning of those two events. And the outcome is our own receptivity to this inner authority. Yes?
Well, that strikes me, especially, show that second image. And I go back to this one. It's like, oh God, if I stay still and listen and see the pattern, this opens up in me.
Yes.
This opens up in me. This is the part of my Red Sea.
This is it. That's
and
right.
And then you said, we are our own caravan.
Yes.
And so we can then...
We share this with each other.
Share this with
and them. We maybe catalyze it in each other. We begin to help each other trust this. It's not just rhetoric that this is happening. I mean, clearly the outer is happening. Our tradition says if you see the outer happening, then trust that I am appearing. Trust the voice of the angel. Begin to listen. Begin to be awake and aware. Know beforehand. Be precognitive. It's an amazing statement that Yeshua makes. Just sort of outlining. And I will give you what you don't normally see. And we take all this rhetoric in as a sweet, you know, wonderful thing to hear from a sacred tradition, and we don't deny it, but it wouldn't happen to a hobbit in Mordor. Wouldn't happen to us, would it? No. We are the ones. And I can sense the intensity. I can sense it in you. So I think I tried to gather everything, and I didn't have all the time in the world to put these. Some of you have seen this image, that lurking again behind the chaos is the angel. The angel of prophecy. And let's see, I want to get to this. And I promise tonight I will put these so I can quickly come, and I may have missed it. I wanted to show you the desert a minute, just so you would see. But no, it's not in that way. No wonder I couldn't. That's us. That's the Oriental Orthodox order in the West. And that's why we do this. That's why this is precious. Because what we're doing together is not that. Yes, we're doing that too. We're gathering like this. That's an old time hotel, Caravanserai. It looked like that. These pictures were taken just when the cameras were first coming out. That's what it looked like when folk gathered at the Oblate centers of the Middle East when it became dark and dangerous to be outside. So that's what we're doing. And we're doing it to encourage one another to build up stamina, to develop a sense of inner sovereignty, to be learn to be brave when what we actually feel is intense fear, and then to practice together so that when it even becomes more intense, we're not taken by surprise, as Yeshua says. So you know before you approach, and you know where they're coming in at. We would like to always feel strong and competent and confident, but the truth is we're very vulnerable, and we feel especially vulnerable when we are alone. And that's one of the difficulties of having an order where the monks are scattered across the face of the earth and only see each other once a year in a kind of caravanserai where we, I'm so glad to see you. It gives me strength to see you, to be with you. But what we're doing is to develop a higher authority. We need the horizontal fellowship and relationship, but we do that to strengthen your capacity to listen to the voice of the angel. Because we're going to need that guidance in the midst of this. So our tradition began this way. This is something we've reflected on many times, that this is the genesis of the Abrahamic traditions, where the three angels appear. And they begin to guide our tradition across the history of the world. This is, of course, Rublev's Trinity, the welcoming of the stranger, and the strangers turned out to be angels. And but the text says, the ancient Hebrew text says, it was the Lord. So the Lord was appearing in the voice of the angel, in the presence of the angel. And in this case, it was a triple. And so that began to happen. That is our heritage. If you're a part of the Abrahamic faith, this is the roots. Our tradition said the Lord did not leave us to be vulnerable and alone, but the angels at the time of critical decision making would appear. And so our tradition witnesses to that all across the ages, and we have images of angels from our tradition, and that is an image of an angel, an ancient angel. And here is another ancient angel. We don't see those as angels, but those are angels. Notice the wings, those are nice. Here's another one. And there's a lot of symbolism built into this, and that's a carved relief of an angel. And that they appear in our tradition across the landscape of the desert. And they meet us. And they meet us especially in the moment of intense chaos. Or at the tipping points. So you could say that Abraham and Sarah were at a tipping point and the angel appeared. And it was the Lord appeared. It was the divine presence appeared. But then our tradition goes on to say, and this is not created by my sister, and I have to go back. That's a more contemporary sense of angel appearance in the midst of battle, in the midst of war. It's not an easy image for me to look at, but maybe that's the kind of intensity that we should begin to imagine. In the course of tradition, the angel of the apocalypse, I think this is, that is one of the images that was imagined, the angel of the apocalypse. But as we begin to think about what our tradition said about the end of history, then those angels would move across the landscape of our world, and here's one of them. And we would begin to trust that those angels of the unveiling would begin to make the new world. And this is Allison's image for me. Expanded? So, we have these texts, and we don't quite know what to do with them, but then when you begin to detect that, oh, this might be it, you pay more attention to them. But remember, I make all things new is in that text. I will make all things new. So the two have to go hand in hand. Oh, make all things new, but, keep me safe. Don't let me be disturbed. I don't want to feel any fear, thank you very much. And, make it easy. But the texts do not say that that's going to be the case. So these are just ways of exciting our imagination. Maybe this is the gentleness of spirit as it begins to hold the world. And again, this is a beautiful image from Allison's work. That one is paired in this with a series. So I will show you the series. You saw that one. And maybe this one. And maybe that one. And maybe that one. But I begin to make all things new. And if that is the case, then perhaps that is the new. So I'm going to conclude with this sense that the Spirit hovering over us and appearing inside of us as a prophetic voice is the outer and the inner truth. The one image of the outer of the Spirit guiding humanity, making things new, using the chaos, using the presence of the angels in the midst of the chaos. And then we each individually are participants. And so this is the image of our own unique personal participation, deep inner listening, the ability from that listening and from that appearance to face the watery chaos. There's no way out of this. Tomorrow we'll begin, we've asked Jim, who's actual life work has been on the prophetic tradition to lead us into a deeper understanding of that. And we'll start that in the morning. And then I'll conclude these thoughts that I've been listening to as deeply as I can to kind of bring this sense so that we have a clarity about what our participation can be. And I opened it up to this need for deep listening. And then the question is, what am I listening for? Or what might be being transmitted to us? What themes and categories might this language come to us through? What means and what subjects and what teachings, and how does that affect my own inner world? So this is a launch. It's intense. You know, we're here just a short time. It's precious. Every moment that we have with each other is precious to me. And, you know, I just wish we could do everything and be together for days and days and days. But we've made a big effort to come together, to love each other, to share with each other, to have each other's backs, to give each other a sense of hope and bravery in the midst of this world. So we'll conclude tonight by saying again, we do this together in the name of the Holy One, the Merciful and the Compassionate. Bismillah, Rahman, Rahim. Amen. Thank you.